This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company, and always streaming at rightscast.net. This episode of Biblio Breakdown is brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing. Dandelion Web Marketing helps authors like you build a thriving platform through strategic web marketing. If you're not sure if you're on the right track with your website, you can get one of their author website audits to find out. And right now, listeners to the RightsCast Network can take 50% off. These audits will look at your site's content, security, design, search engine optimization, and more, and they'll provide you with insight into what you might do to better connect with your audience. So to learn the strengths and weaknesses of your current website and take 50% off along the way, you can visit dandelionwebmarketing.com/rightscast to learn more. That's dandelionwebmarketing.com/rightscast.
A dark hallway, hooded eyes, the hair on the back of your neck standing up. When we run across these things in real life, they make us hike up our shoulders in defense. When we read them within the pages of a novel, they make us shiver with delight. As writers, we have the ability to create a specific atmosphere. We can isolate our characters. We can present our readers with immense mansions where the lights go out at night and our protagonist has to use a flashlight, or better yet, a candle in an old-fashioned holder to watch her step. We can ask hard questions about those monsters we thought were just tales in the dark and give readers answers that will make them screw their eyes shut, only to open them again so they can keep reading. Hi there. I'm Ekta Garg, a reviewer, editor, author, and dreamer of stories and books, and I'm delighted to present this episode of Biblio Breakdown here on the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. In this episode, we're talking about mood, how to set it, and how to make it last, within the context of The Ancestor by Danielle Trussoni. I'll be offering analysis and writing exercises along the way so you can see what this book has done well and put it to practice in your own writing. Let's get started. Picture this. You're going about your ordinary day when you receive the news that you're royalty. Not only are you royalty, but you're the last of your line. You've been asked to fly to Europe so the lawyers for the estate, now your estate, can explain how things work and get you set up in your castle. That's right, castle. At first glance, it might seem like something out of a fairy tale. A whole castle, a royal title, a private jet that whisks you within the hour to the Italian Alps. All we need is a glass slipper and a prince on a white horse, and we're set for a dreamy candy floss kind of story. Except there's no glass slipper here. Just an empty room. A room where Alberta Monty, known as Bert to her friends, wishes she could put a crib and a sleepy time nightlight. A room where she'd love nothing more than to rock a drowsy baby to sleep. At the beginning of Danielle Trussoni's gothic novel, The Ancestor, Bert is in pain. She's experienced yet another miscarriage, and even though her husband, Luca, is nothing but patient and understanding, she just doesn't have the emotional fortitude to be a part of a couple. Bert has asked Luca for a separation, which causes more pain, but also gives her the space to take care of herself for a little while. Luca agrees to move out of their small home in Milton, New York, even though he's convinced they're going to get back together again. They've known each other since they were kids. Their families are from the same little village back in the mountains of Italy and even migrated to the United States around the same time. According to Luca, he and Bert are destined to be together. Bert doesn't agree, which is why she wants the separation, but it also leaves her feeling incredibly alone. She's an only child and her parents died ages ago. Some of her most favorite people are in Luca's family, which means that those people are no longer available to her. At least in her mind, they aren't. On top of everything else, it's December, the time when families are getting ready to celebrate the holidays together. Bert, though, has no more family left. Danielle Trussoni gives readers almost all of this information within just the first two pages of the book, and just like that, she's set the mood. She's given us a protagonist who is sad, and started her story at a time of year when the sadness for many people is magnified. As if this wasn't enough, Bert is fully aware that her separation from Luca is something of her own design. She doesn't hold Luca responsible in the least. At the top of page 2, Bert says, "We had been together for nearly 10 years, and despite the problems, which were mostly my problems, as we would both agree, it was hard to imagine life without him." Even before Bert finds out about her incredible inheritance, we can sense that something is coming for her. Something big and life-changing. Like most of you, I haven't visited Milton, New York in December, but we can guess that the sky is probably overcast. At the very least, it's probably bitterly cold. A person has to wear layers to stay warm, which could be taken as a metaphor for the layers in the book. It could also be taken as a metaphor for the ways a character might arm herself against what is yet to come. And what exactly is that? It's a mysterious package of documents. It comes from Turin, Italy, and it's addressed to Alberta Isabel Eleanor Vittoria Montebianco. Talk about a mouthful. Even the name contributes to the mood. Whatever is in that package, Bert knows it's going to create a lot of complications for her and possibly Luca. She's sure of that last part because, as we already know, she has no other family to help her sort it out. Still, she gives it a shot and discovers that all of the documents are in Italian, which Bert neither reads nor understands. So she gives Luca a call, who suggests she ask his grandmother, Sophia, for help in translating the papers. Nonna Sophia, as Luca calls her, helps parse out the details for Bert, but she isn't thrilled about it. Apparently, everyone from Nonna Sophia's generation who came with her to the States knew the reason why they had to leave Nevinero, the tiny village tucked into the Italian Alps. It has to do with Bert's grandfather, Giovanni, and the Montebianco family. In the 19th century, the Montebiancos ruled part of Italy with an iron fist. Now, there's only one blood relative left, Bert. How would you feel if you found this out about yourself? Bert is freaked out. If the documents didn't have her name on them, she wouldn't even believe they were meant for her. But Nonna Sophia's reaction makes her uneasy. Then, one of the lawyers for the estate arrives from Italy and convinces Bert that she is, in fact, heir to the Montebianco name, the castle, and the estate. Of course, to claim any of it, she has to go to Italy as soon as possible. On the spur of the moment, Bert asks Luca to join her. Maybe, she thinks, this will be the fresh start they need. And for the first hours after their arrival, everything does seem to be a little like that fairy tale. The estate provides amazing, expensive clothes for them, and they eat a wonderful meal. They're staying in a high-end hotel. Bert and Luca talk about how royal money could change their lives. It's like Bert has left all the bad things from her life behind. Of course, every fairy tale has its villain. Bert forgets that Luca has grown up with Nonna Sophia and other family members who knew the Montebianco family, Bert's family, from before they came to the U.S. The two get into an argument about families and how Bert's family in particular was shunned, to quote Luca, by other Italian immigrants in Milton. In a fit of anger, Luca leaves Italy and Bert decides to stay in Turin so she can travel to the village of Nevinero close by. If Luca doesn't understand her, well, she has a family estate now. Somewhere in the castle, and she still can't believe she's the heir to a castle, somewhere in there she'll find answers to her questions. Like why Nonna Sophia said that the people had, quote unquote, forgiven Bert's grandfather. Forgiven him for what? In some ways, Bert is also looking for answers about her own inadequacies, like why she can't be a mother. Her parents aren't around to help study her ancestry, but now there's a castle full of her heritage, a castle full of documents and memories to help her sort out who she really is. Author Danielle Trussoni sets all of this up in the first 60 pages of a book that's 345 pages long. The pace is steady, and it's definitely building towards something. With a practiced touch, though, she lets readers in on a secret. Bert already knows how all of this is going to end. When she and Luca first get to Italy, they change their clothes and go out for a meal. In the middle of describing the meal, Bert says, "Whether it was because I had never tasted such food, or because it was my first and last meal with Luca in Italy, I have never, not before or since, tasted anything quite like that dinner. I think of it as akin to the last meal of the condemned, one eaten in the final moments of a life to give comfort and strength before an unknown journey. Because a treacherous journey awaited me, and while I had no idea of the difficulties I would face and the ways in which my life would be forever changed, I did embark well-fed. And all of this before we even know what journey Bert will have to take sets the mood for the entire book. For your first writing exercise, I'd like you to pull out an old story, something you haven't read or looked at in a long time. It would be ideal if it's a copy of the story that you can mark up, like a printout or a photocopy of the piece. Now, keep some paper or a writing journal nearby, and then read the story, start to finish, without stopping. Once you're done, jot down a few notes about how the story made you feel. Try to keep these as big picture feelings: happy, sad, frustrated, empowered, angry, hopeful. Don't worry about expressing yourself in full sentences. In fact, it would be better if you just use phrases. Now, pick the most prominent feeling, let's say happy, and go back to the story. Pay close attention as you read it again, and this time underline every phrase or line that specifically made you feel happy. Was it a description of a sunny house? Maybe it was when a character laughs in delight after a line of dialogue. Make a note of all the moments that made you happy. Then ask yourself this: was the main point of writing this story to make readers happy? If the answer is yes, then go back to the parts you didn't underline. Why didn't you underline them? Were they serving some other purpose in the piece, like, say, a transition? In those sections or pieces you didn't underline, are there portions that contradict that happiness you're trying to portray? Are there any parts of the story that would confuse your reader and make them sad instead? While mood is a crucial component of Gothic novels like The Ancestor, it can play an important role in any genre. We may not pay as close attention to it if we're writing, say, women's fiction or fantasy, but the mood is often tied to the emotions of the story and the characters. So we have to be absolutely clear on what that mood is. Sometimes we get sidetracked in our stories. We discover another character or a setting that intrigues us, and we start to travel down that path for a little while. If we're not crystal clear in every paragraph and on every page in how we want to make our readers feel, they're going to get confused. If we confuse them enough, they'll stop reading, and we definitely don't want that.
The pre-order window is now open for Kill Your Darlings Candle Company's debut line of candles. But that pre-order window, well, it won't be open much longer. As of this episode's posting, Their Happily Ever After, Dramatic Irony, and Kill Your Darlings Original Scents are all available online with a 20% discount if you order between now and July 31st, 2020. Not only do orders placed during this period receive 20% off, but donations to one of Kill Your Darlings' community benefactors will be doubled during this time. Yes, that's right. If you order before July 31st, 2020, you'll get 20% off, and Kill Your Darlings will donate 10% of your order's subtotal to a writing, reading, or literacy-oriented organization of your choosing at checkout. But even if you're listening outside the Kill Your Darlings Candle Company pre-order window, Kill Your Darlings still has a lot on offer and runs sales all the time. So visit kydcandleco.com/store now to check out their debut candles and take advantage of whatever sale they have going on before it comes to an end. Again, that address is kydcandleco.com/store. Kill Your Darlings Candles. Candles for the wordsmiths of the world.
Building a mood within a story or a book is about word choice, and The Ancestor does this incredibly well. Let's take another look at how. Bert Monti is in Turin, Italy, alone. Her husband Luca has left for the States after they've had a fight, even though in her heart of hearts, Bert really doesn't want to be exploring her heritage by herself. But she can't forget the hurtful things he said about her family, the very same family that has made her a countess by ancestry and whose estate she's about to embrace. So Bert is going to forge ahead without Luca. Back at the hotel, she meets with the three lawyers of the estate. As she walks into the conference room, Bert takes in the scene. She tells us, "They sat in a windowless conference room, some folders piled between them. An enormous bouquet of lilies dominated a side table, filling the air with a heavy funereal scent. Aside from the morbid odor of the flowers, the atmosphere was antiseptic, impersonal, businesslike, lawyerly. Many of us would normally associate flowers with something positive. When I delivered my first child, my husband bought a huge bouquet of stargazer lilies and brought them to me in the hospital. Since then, every time I see stargazer lilies or catch their scent, I smile. It reminds me of his sweet gesture and of becoming a mother for the first time. Here, though, Danielle Trussoni takes flowers and reminds us of another place they're often used. At funerals, when someone dies. You'd think that if Bert is meeting the lawyers who are going to give her the keys to her personal kingdom, she'd be ecstatic, ready to embrace life as a royal. Yet because the author is writing a gothic novel, and because she has a particular track in mind for her story, she's chosen to give us a different mental picture, one where death, or at the very least danger or destruction, are imminent. This becomes immediately obvious when Bert sits down with the lawyers and starts reviewing the documents of the estate. In addition to the castle home of the Montebiancos, Bert has inherited a family coat of arms, jewels, artwork, an apartment in Paris, the family forestry business, and a lot of debt. The royal family of the House of Montebianco is broke. Think of it. Learning in America that you're royalty, only to land in Europe and discover that royal name is just that, a name. Still, the lawyers convince Bert to visit the castle. She's the only living heir with Montebianco blood in her, but there is a relative by marriage, her great-aunt Dolores, who Bert didn't even know existed, who was waiting to meet her. Great-aunt Dolores is old and most likely won't live much longer, but she's held on this long. Bert gets the feeling something is not quite right, but she has nowhere else, really, where she can go. So, she travels to the castle. It's tucked in the folds of the Italian Alps just above the village of Nevignero. In fact, the only way to get to it is by helicopter. When Bert gets out of the chopper, it's nighttime, of course. Stories like these don't take place on a sunny summer day. Bert takes a minute to get her bearings, and she describes what she sees. A few lights flickered in the castle's windows, but no one had come to greet me. I zipped my coat closed, bracing against the sharp wind. The cold was so domineering that it had overtaken the stone. An entire wall of the castle was encased in ice, as if a wave had washed up on it and, in a snap of sub-zero wind, frozen in place. She's supposed to be the Countess Alberta Isabel Eleanor Vittoria Montebianco, and yet no one's bothered to say hello when she arrives at the castle that technically now belongs to her. Bert continues to make note of her surroundings. I looked up to the star-spattered sky. It was a black bowl filled with diamonds, glittering and inaccessible. The helicopter was gone. I was on my own. Once again, Danielle Trussoni has used something we would normally associate with luxury, in this case, a bowl full of diamonds, and turned it into something that shimmers not with the promise of a new life, but with the menace of a terrible past, a terrible secret, because that's exactly what Bert starts to piece together after she finally meets Great Aunt Dolores. By taking a trope, a common person learning about a royal heritage, and turning it on its head, Trussoni convinces readers that there's more than one way of looking at this formula. Her expert handling of her word choice and going in an unexpected direction definitely keeps readers moving through the book, and she doesn't hesitate to put Bert in harm's way. Our protagonist has just enough time to get her bearings after the helicopter leaves when she's attacked by a guard dog. Talk about a memorable welcome. The inside of the castle is just as oppressive as the outside, though. After the groundskeeper corrals the dog, a servant escorts Bert inside. Bert describes her first encounter with the interior of the castle like this. The wind died in an instant, and a pervasive silence filled the air. Over time, I would come to understand this silence, the thickness of it, its almost tangible viscosity, as the defining nature of the mountains. A quiet, choking presence that suffocated one slowly, breath by breath. If you've ever seen pictures of the Alps, you'll know they're astounding in their beauty. They inspire people to hike and even sing. One look and you can see why the hills are alive. But here, Bert sees the mountains as a deadly force. The mountains and the castle both stand as stark reminders to Bert that she's a long way from home. Author Danielle Trussoni does a wonderful job of reminding readers of this with these feather-touch descriptions before moving the plot along. She keeps circling back to different parts of the castle, though, in case we've forgotten how intimidating it can be. Once Bert has met Great Aunt Dolores, she goes on a little excursion to explore her new inherited home, and she says, "With its twisting hallways and staircases, its communicating corridors and bricked-up doors and circular rooms with multiple exits, the castle soon became a frustrating maze. After 30 minutes of wandering, I was thoroughly lost. For the most part, the castle was gloomy. Pools of gray shadow collected in every corner, and by afternoon, the place was dark as night." Trussoni uses the setting, both the natural one and the man-made one, to drive home the pervasive mood that something just isn't right with all of this. If Bert took a minute to think about it with a clear head, she'd realize it too. But Bert isn't thinking with a clear head. She's thinking with her heart. She wants answers about her past and her ancestors. She wants to know why she can't carry a baby to full term. She wants to know why her grandfather left Nevanyera in what seems more and more to be like shame. Nonna Sophia, Luca's grandmother back in New York, definitely seemed to imply it, and Great Aunt Dolores does too. What, Bert wants to know, could possibly have happened in the mountains to drive her grandfather Giovanni from his birthplace and the centuries-old home of the Montebianco family? As we slowly get answers, the mood of the book continues to help build that anticipation. For your next writing exercise, go back to that story you marked up. This time, let's concentrate on the setting. Again, you don't have to be writing a gothic novel. Mood isn't restricted to dark and stormy nights. Take out a pen in a different color or maybe even a highlighter. This time, mark all the parts of the story that have to do with setting, both natural, like if a part of your story takes place outdoors, and man-made. For instance, that restaurant where one character is about to propose to another. If your story is a happy one, what about the setting makes it happy? What specific elements have you built in to contribute to that warm, fuzzy feeling of contentment and that all is right with the world? What is the lighting like? In that restaurant, is there a cloth covering the table? Live music playing? Is the wait staff particularly helpful? Did your characters get a table with a wonderful view? If the story is outdoors, is the sun shining? Are your characters in a meadow full of wildflowers or walking through the forest on a spring day? Whatever it might be, make sure the setting and all of its elements emphasize for your readers that this is a happy piece. Let's say your story is supposed to be sad or somber or to express a character's anger at life. What in your setting reiterates these feelings? How do you use the features of your setting to convey the mood of your characters? If your story is more serious, think of adding muted or neutral colors, dark clothes, or even a dark atmosphere. If your characters are sitting in a restaurant, maybe they had to escape the rain and now have to sit through their meal soaking wet. Maybe a waiter is particularly rude. Let's say one of the characters was looking forward to a particular item on the menu, but the kitchen is out of it. The one who wants to propose starts to do so, but the other person anticipates the proposal and turns it down. Even in describing these things, the mood has gone from light and happy to dark and depressing. As easily as I'm giving you these ideas here, you can take the setting of your story or book and use them to reflect the mood and the emotions you want to portray. One of the biggest advantages of this is that it'll go a long way toward the show, don't tell advice writing experts always give. If you proceed with your story in a thoughtful, precise way, not once do you have to name the emotion. You don't have to say happy or sad or any of the other words we use to describe how we feel. The elements of your story will do it for you.
All right, it's time to talk about Scrivener. Yes, Scrivener, this is some software that I absolutely adore. I've been using it to get myself to the page since 2012, 2013, however long it's been now. I can't imagine sitting down to write a manuscript without Scrivener. And why is that, you ask? Isn't it just a place where you hit your keyboard and letters show up on the screen? Well, sure. I mean, most word processing software is exactly that. But Scrivener is so much more. Because it's designed with writers in mind, there are so many great features you aren't going to get anywhere else. Not only is Scrivener the place where you can write your manuscript, you can actually also throw in things like character notes and setting description, and anything that you think might be important can be saved all in one easy-to-navigate document that you can jump between without having to have a million windows open or needing to wait for a hundreds of pages long document to load from the cloud. It's all right there for you, and it'll help you whether you're an outliner, whether you are a pantser, whether you are something in between. Scrivener is here to help. And right now, you can help support the WritesCast Network by visiting bit.ly/writing software and downloading a 30-day free trial of Scrivener to get started and see if you like it. At bit.ly/writing software, you can download Scrivener right to your desktop or to your laptop, whether you use a Mac or are on Windows. Either will work, and you can give Scrivener a test run for 30 days. Totally free, no obligation, and if at the end of those 30 days you'd like to keep using Scrivener, which I think you will, well, you can keep it, and the WritesCast Network will get a little something for your having given it a shot. So again, that's bit.ly/writing software where you can get started with Scrivener today.
Of course, the characters drive your story forward. Danielle Trussoni has given readers memorable people who contribute to the overall sense that something is wrong. Let's look at some of them now. When Bert meets Greta, the main housekeeper of the castle, she describes her like this. A shuffling of feet alerted me that someone was coming. I turned to find a short, fat woman in a heavy wool coat. Greta wore a wool stocking cap pulled down over her ears, and I could just make out a series of scars on the left side of her face. We don't even see Greta at first. We hear her shuffling feet. Have you ever walked with shuffling feet? It's a stride that might be taken by someone who's tired. Often, in writing, though, it's given to a character who is insecure or sad about something. It's possible Greta is both. Scars on a person's face that are visible, even if you've got a cap pulled down to your ears, would most likely make anyone feel low self-esteem. Great Aunt Dolores, it turns out, is more or less a normal old woman with gnarled hands and confined to a wheelchair, but that doesn't stop her from expressing herself in harsh terms. She says to Bert, "You were raised far from here, far from your birthright, far from the traditions and expectations for the Montebianco family. But now you are here, Alberta, and I will tell you this. You have a duty to fulfill. You have responsibilities to perform. You must come to understand your inheritance and take charge of it, or you will find that your inheritance will take charge of you." More than a physical description, this tells us a lot about Dolores as a person. In the most subtle of ways, it also contributes to the idea that all of this is inevitable for Bert. Even if she has no desire to take the family name, she really doesn't have a choice. The cast of unique characters continues. At one point, Bert is shot and needs immediate medical attention. Because of how remote the village is and how the people of Nevenero have essentially shut off contact with Dolores and the castle staff, Bert has to rely on the people immediately around her for help. Sal, the groundskeeper, has brought Bert to her room and at the start of chapter 21 says the line that tells us right away what we need to know about the person assigned to help Bert. "Bernadette is good with knives," Sal said by way of introduction. I looked up to see the cook looking down upon me. She had a plump, cheerful face with round, rosy cheeks, huge eyes, and a double chin, giving her the appearance of a ghoulish child. She stood next to Sal, her skin glistening with candlelight. Now, what would you say if you were suffering from a bullet wound and had to trust your life to a ghoulish child? Even in those two words, the author is slipping in a nod to the book's genre. The novel radiates melancholy, and this comes through most strongly in Bert and the way she views her life. Later, when she's examining her wound in Bernadette's handiwork, as it is, Bert says, "I know that Bernadette, with all of her expertise with knives, didn't perform the most elegant of surgeries. She removed the bullet the way one might have done during the Napoleonic Wars, with a sharp blade and lots of liquor." The most extreme character description comes from a diary that Bert is given. The family record keeper lends Bert the diary of Eleanor, her great-great-grandmother. Eleanor is writing about her daughter, Vittoria, or Vita for short. In the diary, she says, No one, not even the other members of the Montebianco family, was allowed to see Vita. She was so hideous, so lacking in human refinements, that she remained locked away in the Northeast Tower as if she were a devil in our midst. It was necessary to hide her. She could not, under any circumstance, be allowed to roam freely. I can only imagine what she would do with such liberty. No doubt she would feast on the village babies and dance naked in the moonlight. This description stuns Bert. What could it possibly mean? How could someone, a mother no less, write about their own child that way? As Bert continues to read the diary, she learns more about Vita and her place in the family. Bert also discovers the core of the family secrets, and in the cold light of day, it would be easy to dismiss them. The author, though, has done such a careful job of laying one delicate layer on top of another, of building the mood of the book through her word choice and setting and character description, that by the time we get the big reveal, we're willing to believe it and anything else presented to us in this story world. And this takes us to our last writing exercise for this breakdown. Go back to that story you marked up. Review the strongest emotions that come out of the story and make sure those are the emotions you want to convey. Now, look at your cast of characters. Make a list of them in a column, and then across the page, list everything about each character that supports the mood you're trying to build. If this is a story about anger, how do your characters depict it? What about their facial features, or their clothes, or the way they talk, reiterates for your readers the mood of the piece? Maybe happy characters are wearing bright colors and light, airy fabrics. They lift their chins with confidence and stand up straight. Sad characters hunch their shoulders, don't meet anyone's eye, wear dark clothes that don't fit well. A character who is trying to control every element of his life might dress in a sharp suit where the creases in his pants are perfect and he carries an expensive briefcase. Now, dig deeper into your characters. Are the happy ones talkative, reaching out when their friends need a shoulder to lean on? Are the egocentric characters thinking about how everything in their lives affects only them, even if it's being struck in a traffic jam? What about your characters reinforces what you're trying to accomplish with the overarching feeling you want your readers to take away from your piece? At the end of her book, Danielle Trussoni drives home the melancholy and the lurking danger. Bert has discovered the truth about her past, and she's agreed to be the keeper of the secrets of the House of Montebianco. She even agrees to live in the castle forever. It reminds her of everything she's lost, because she does lose things throughout the course of the book, but it also reminds her of the fact that she's gained her family. Maybe not in a tangible way where she can hug them and talk to them, but she has her ancestry, and that's enough for her. Her yearning is coupled with a hint of optimism, and we see it in the very last line of the book when Bert says, "When I am in doubt and I feel I might fail, I recall my ancestors dancing at the fire, that rich and noble tribe, and I know that I am not alone." Her mood and the mood of the ancestor as a novel is cemented by everything readers have seen with Bert, and everyone knows that she's right. Despite it all, she's not alone. So whether it's high in the mountains of Italy or on the sidewalk of a bustling city, or even if it is on a dark and stormy night, take care in the writing to let readers know just what mood your story and your characters are in. Your readers will keep coming back for more, whether they're reading on their back porch on a sunny afternoon or under a blanket on a cold winter's evening, shivering and also delighting in the story that you tell. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or found its exercises useful, please leave the WritesCast Network a rating and review on wherever you listen to podcasts. This will help the WritesCast Network reach more writers like you, and building that sense of community is what we, and I hope you, are all about. To those of you who have already left us a rating and review, thank you very much. Additional thanks go to the WritesCast Network's patrons who contribute to our programming financially at patreon.com/WritesCast. For their support, WritesCast Network patrons get some great perks, including WritesCast swag, discounts on R.R. Campbell's editing services, and entries in monthly drawings for partial manuscript critiques. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can join patrons like Laura Hazen and Angeline Boley in supporting our programming directly today at $1, $2, or $3 per episode or per month. Any level of contribution will get you access to some of those fantastic patron perks. So become a supporter today by making your pledge at patreon.com/rightscast. That's patreon.com/rightscast. Thanks as well to our on-air sponsors, Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and the Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. To learn more about them or our other sponsors, you can visit rightscast.net/sponsors. You can stay in touch with us by visiting rightscast.net or by saying hello on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram with the handle @rightscast or by searching for the Rightscast Network. We're also available by email at rightscast@gmail.com, or you can call us at 608-284-8342, where you can leave a voicemail with questions for future guests or other matters you'd like us to address in future programming. Again, that number is 608-284-8342. To reach me personally, you can visit The Right Edge, that's W-R-I-T-E, at therightedge.wordpress.com, or find me on Instagram and Twitter with my handle, at Ektaargarg, that's E-K-T-A-R-G-A-R-G. Thanks again for listening. Until we meet again, this is Ektaargarg. Right on and right well.
This is the Rightscast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company, and always streaming at rightscast.net.